This is the son of PCJ. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone. It's very nice to have you with us once again. CKUT is a very well-respected campus community radio station located in Montreal, Canada. It's actually based at McGill University. Now, they're in a bit of an odd situation right now because students at McGill are taking part in a referendum whether or not they want the station to survive.
Well, a few months ago, we had on the show a Brit who worked as a broadcaster in Lebanon. Today, an American who hosted the number one English language program in China. We'll bring you part one of a two-part interview with Rick O'Shea.
Staying in China, how many of you have heard of the World Media Summit? Well, if you don't know anything about it, don't worry, it's not surprising, because there were no foreign media there attending to cover it. Our correspondent in Beijing will join us on the line for more details.
Something that you may not know. Keith and I should actually not be here today.
That's true. We should be flying around with little angel wings, looking down amongst everybody else, except everybody else is dead.
That's right. So what's this all about? Well, after the doomsday prediction on May 21st came and went, Harold Camping, who runs Family Radio, predicted that the world would end on October 21st. Well, we're still here. We contact Family Radio for a statement. Well, that's all we'll say right now, but there's always room for a bit of comedy, so stay tuned.
That's certainly true. Media Network Plus, talking from beyond the grave with little angel wings. Ah, we're being little angels. First, here's Paulette with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
For nearly 53 years, Harold Camping has been a prominent figure in Christian broadcasting. On Monday, the Christian Post was exclusively told that the 90-year-old was no longer able to lead his family radio ministry and would be retiring. During the last several years, the Family Radio Network has suffered operating losses. Two of their stations, WKDN in Philadelphia and WFSI in Annapolis, Maryland, which covers the Washington, D.C. area, are being sold, tentatively, to CBS. On Monday, Family Radio began soliciting donations to offset those losses, even though the broadcasting outlets currently owned by the company are potentially worth hundreds of millions. The Chinese government has extended a grant of 200 million yuan, that's about 31.5 million U.S. dollars, to South Sudan for development projects in the newly independent state. The grant was announced on Monday in Juba after a meeting between South Sudanese Minister of Information and Broadcasting, Barnaba Mariel Benjamin, and the Chinese ambassador to Juba, Li Zhigua. Ambassador Zhigua said the grant is dedicated to support agriculture, education, health, and water supply projects. He further said that Beijing government will donate a number of radio stations to South Sudan to promote media development. The Australian government has found itself in a tangle over the contract to televise Australia to the world. The tender for the 10-year, $233 million U.S. dollar Australian network is a contest between Sky News and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Australian Network is funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Canberra, managed by the ABC, and beamed to dozens of countries in the Asia-Pacific region. The drawn-out tender process has prompted claims of political interference and deliberate leaks on who should win the contract. An editorial in the Los Angeles Times severely criticizes Radio TV Marti. The newspaper says, "It's disappointing that the U.S., which in recent years has taken steps to improve relations with Cuba, has opted to sustain and expand these anachronistic broadcasts that serve no purpose other than to placate Cuban exiles in Miami and stoke Castro's anti-American rants." The newspaper says, "Congress ought to stop pretending that Radio and TV Marti remain relevant. And if President Obama is interested in reaching the Cuban people, he should push Congress to lift the travel ban. Person-to-person contact, not spam, is the way to win the hearts and minds of Cubans, the LA Times concluded. Romanian news TV station Antena 3 has signed an agreement with CNN International, which allows the Romanian station to broadcast news shows from CNN. In return, Antena 3's stories will also be broadcast by CNN International. Romanian Antena 3 is owned by the Intact Group, controlled by the Voiculescu family. The TV station is the first in Romania to be affiliated with CNN International. Special thanks to Andy Sennett at the Radio Netherlands Worldwide Media Network blog for the material used here today. For more information from Andy, visit his blog, http://blogs.rnw.nl/media network, or you can find a link at the PCJ website, www.pcjmedia.com.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio, heard on great partner stations everywhere. CKUT in Montreal is one of the most vibrant campus community radio stations in Canada. The station will be celebrating its 25th anniversary very soon. 40% of its funds come from students at McGill University. But this could be in jeopardy, as students from McGill will be voting in a referendum on whether or not to have a tiny portion of their student fees go towards CKUT. Louise Burns from CKUT tells me how having 40% of its funds reduced would have an impact on the station.
If you can imagine losing 40% of any budget, it's a huge blow if you don't have it. In addition, if this referendum, which is a referendum asking the question to undergraduate McGill students whether they want the continued existence of the station, by virtue of paying a fee, each student pays a full-time SSMU or undergraduate student pays $4 a semester. If we lose that, then the administration is not obliged to sign any agreement with us, which is necessary to exist. Our license, we are no longer tied to a campus, so our license would be in question, as well as the place that the studio is located at is a McGill building, so that is also a big problem.
Now, the referendum, of course, is coming up. Is there a sense amongst the volunteers and also the paid staff, you know, if this doesn't go the way we hope it does, what do we do?
We have been thinking about that plan B for many years. Soon as the kind of nature of our arrangement with the university changed, and it changed by the fact that they insisted on a lot more means by which students can reaffirm the existence of the station. And so being in a constant sort of state of having to defend our existence, you obviously start thinking very seriously about the plan B. To the extent that we had met with the CRTC and have sort of discussed things with other organizations in terms of what we would do, we feel really strongly that we want to stay as a campus community radio station. We really think it's a very complementary relationship in terms of the educational experience, that education is beyond the classroom, and that we have a lot of students who are interning and who are really making a really valid and, a complement to their education, where they're doing internships for independent study, for academic credit here. And that education is just priceless. And so I really think it's important that we have that educational component, that we have the security of the student fees, so that we're not reinventing ourselves to be like, either more commercial, having to, start doing things to increase our popularity, which sometimes doesn't always work well with increasing the quality. Sometimes the drive for popularity actually makes the sound of the station not as interesting, not as grassroots, a little bit more phony, actually.
Now, with this referendum coming up, because there have been past referendums, is this something that happens on a regular basis?
Currently, it's happening every 5 years. Why I say that we're in a position of defending ourselves is that in 2007, the administration imposed a system whereby students can opt out of paying their student fees online. And so we have been battling that quite a bit because that has been a slow bleed on our finances by virtue of the convenience. And what we are arguing is that it is not informed consent, that our fees are no longer being considered as $4, but rather as the total of all the fees that someone could opt out of. So we're not arguing for $4, we're arguing for $34 or along that line.
Hi, this is Professor Sandy Perlman of the Schulich School of Music, producer of The Clash and the Blue Oyster Cult, and let's not forget the awesome Dictators. I am the person portrayed by Christopher Walken in the Saturday Night Live Cowbell skit, and you are listening to 90.3 CKUT Montreal.
I was speaking there with Louise Burns from CKUT. In an upcoming edition of the program, we'll have a more in-depth look at CKUT 90.3 Radio McGill.
Now, here's an excellent idea. Let's bring together the head honchos of the world-leading media outlets. Bring them together to discuss a variety of topics: cooperation, marketing, distribution of content, and censorship. Oops. We shouldn't include that last one because the World Media Summit took place in Beijing, and this was the only subject that was not discussed. The other thing we should point out is that no foreign media outlets were invited to cover the summit. Only a very small handful of local Chinese media and Chinese state news agency Xinhua. Our correspondent in Beijing, Jocelyn Ford, now joins us for more.
Let me give you the official line first, okay? It's about cooperation. Can't go wrong with that, right? Partnership between traditional media and new emerging media. Can't go wrong with that, right? I mean, you know, we all want to know what's going on there. It's about research and consultation on the constantly changing media landscape. Okay, sounds good, right? Now,
sounds great. Yeah. Sounds wonderful. I would love to go myself.
But you have to ask what's really going on here. And when I called up various news organizations who had their top honchos, the big cheeses, at this meeting, look, people are flying all over the world from Russia Eat Our Task, from the Associated Press, from Reuters, from the New York Times publisher was there. They're flying from all over the world, and I was told, oh, you know, they have 30 minutes each for each topic on the agenda, which happened to include safety of journalists in disaster zones and happened to include intellectual property. They're not saying anything. We're not sending a reporter there. This is not worthy of the reporting. So you have to say, okay, what is this really about? Well, China's policy, as probably you know and many in the audience may know, of going out and having its voice heard in the world, it needs to get some credibility for its media. And what better way than to hold a high-profile, holding court with all of the media moguls from around the world coming and paying attention to you and giving you credibility or face and, getting your message out there through them eventually is their dream. How it's actually working
out. So in other words, then, Jocelyn, this just sounds like a big show.
I think it was. Now, it was a big show that, unfortunately, I can't say anything definitively about because it seems that no foreign media, they had a media meet the press briefing after the conference, which was a one-day conference this year. But I learned about it that day, and nobody answered the phone when I tried to get accreditation, and I talked to other journalists who couldn't get in either, and the only news reports were out on Chinese media. Xinhua was most of them, Russian state media had a report. The report basically said that there will be another conference in Moscow, and we're hosting it. So, it's a bit of a secret. It would seem. Now, I did try to talk to somebody who was there. I messaged him, and he just, I said, well, was anything out there on press freedom issues? Because, you would think that all of these folks coming to China, talking about safety of journalists, when one of the main reasons that Chinese journalists, at least, are in prison is because they violated state safety regulations. There was recently a journalist who was reporting on a rape case where women were locked up for years and somebody was apparently murdered. And that journalist was then accused of violating state security because apparently it made the local city look bad and they were trying to enhance their reputation, something of that nature. I mean, did any of this sensitive stuff come up? He said, oh, only in the most gentlest terms. Everyone was very polite. So you have to, say, what are these guys in it for? Why are they coming here?
You see, that sounds a little strange to me because even recently, the Director General of the BBC World Service said that we have to do something to combat media censorship in China. So is he just showing, two different faces when he would go to this conference and just be gentle and not really bringing up the hardcore issues that are on the table?
I mean, at the end of the day, I can only speculate, but I assume it's about business. It's about business deals. It's about foreign media companies not, having in financial troubles around the world and thinking of China as, a possible place to consume their products, and they don't want to offend this possible customer. The other thing on the ground here is that visas for foreign journalists have become rather difficult to get. This year, especially, I've been involved in a survey trying to track journalists who are being refused visas, journalists who are spending 8 months applying for a media bureau here. Some of these are major U.S. media organizations, by the way. Nothing to sniff at. They're household names in the United States. Don't have a bureau here, want to open it, have waited 8 months. So perhaps these types of people are interested in trying to facilitate their work here, shall we say. And mind you, you would think that they might want to make a stink at this conference because at the same time as foreign journalists aren't getting visas or having difficulties getting visas in China, Chinese media is expanding rapidly internationally. Now, I've been told by somebody for the state-run CCTV that they're opening a 50-person bureau in Washington, D.C., and another major broadcast center in Nairobi, in Africa. And, Chinese journalists are traveling overseas, far and wide, and presumably getting visas to do so.
Now, just a moment ago, you mentioned cooperation. One thing I'm just sort of curious about, because as you know, it is not uncommon to hear, let's say, China Radio International and some other cities around the world. They go in, they'll buy, say, a block of time on a local radio station. CCTV is carried on cable systems around the world. But the BBC, Voice of America, National Public Radio, other major international news outlets are forbidden to have their content airing on local Chinese media outlets unless, let's say, it's a language lesson. So how do they see that as a business opportunity?
Well, I think, if you've got companies like Bloomberg, which I don't believe was at the meeting, or at least is not in the presidium, shall we say, the leadership committee, which does involve all the other bigwigs that you've mentioned earlier. But they certainly, China is a huge market for their terminals, their business terminals. Reuters Financial News, they're in competition with Xinhua Financial News. China is a huge market for them. You've got, AP has its TV. It has business relations with Chinese media. I think there's a lot of sharing of material. And again, this is an area where when China's stated policy is to get its voice heard around the world. And I'm aware of certain deals where CCTV has said, okay, to a European broadcaster, you use our Chinese reporter on breaking news in China, put him on your airwaves, and we'll use your local, your European reporter, and when there's a breaking news story in your country, we'll put him on our airwaves. You see, Baidu is now launching Thai language Arabic coverage. You see, a Chinese company is trying to buy Yahoo, right? Mm-hmm. You see, and Xinhua is trying to make itself more famous. It's bought big screen in Times Square in New York City. So, China is also potentially, you know, I don't know if they're how much business they bring elsewhere in the world, but I do think that it's the business deals to get access to Chinese pictures, access to Chinese information.
Right, but isn't there the risk then, Jocelyn? Let's say a TV network in Europe says, okay, we'll use, let's say, a local reporter to do the story for us. Isn't there then the risk that the story will be censored?
Well, the story will no doubt be from the point of view of China's state, because it's by China's state media. And the question is, and I don't know how many companies may have such agreements if they are already existent. It was sent to me by a reporter who was apparently quite upset by it because the contract which I saw, which was not signed, let me say, specified that the reporter must be a full-fledged employee of that state media, of CCTV. Yeah. Therefore, I mean, you know, people are buying Chinese propaganda or exchanging propaganda. And at a time when other media organizations are having financial difficulties, you can see that this would be a temptation.
It sounds like a way for the censors in China to reach outward with their censorship and to try to have more control. I mean, it's been stated in some articles that I've recently read that in China right now, there is more censorship than there was, let's say, 5 years ago.
No, I mean, I definitely think, I mean, China's state, its policy is to have its voice heard around the world. And it's talking about reform at the World Media Summit. It was talking about a couple of things, which from a free media perspective are rather disturbing. It was talking about a common code of conduct. There were no details. And again, I have not read any of the media moguls' views on this. And if it was indeed said at the meeting, this was just a media report. There is also comment about reforming the global media order, whatever that means. I mean, presumably it means we need more friendly news about China. That's friendly, you know, that sort of thing. But that's being a little bit facetious. I mean, that was not stated. It was not written down. But China certainly, Chinese state media is often saying that for international media is overly critical of China, too much negative news. They want more positive news. And fair enough. I mean, I think it's fine that Chinese media wants to, you know, it should be able to say what it wants. I believe in that. But they should also allow foreign international media to say what it wants in China. And that's the problem of this. Absolutely no reciprocity here. These folks show up, it was held in the fancy Diaoyutai guest house. I mean, to tell you the truth, I was ready to, you know, show up at the door of that meeting, but I knew if I went to Diaoyutai and you don't have a pass to get in, they won't let you pass the gate to walk the whole mile to the fancy guest house to where the meeting was taking place. So that sort of didn't work out. I actually even wrote to the ombudsman of the New York Times with some of these questions about, you know, what does it say that your publisher is at this meeting and was, you know, were media freedoms issues, were your principles brought up? Did you try to say how they will fit into this or into this World Media Summit? And I was bounced around. I was, you know, I felt like the ping pong ball, ping pong diplomacy here. Told, oh, you're a journalist, go talk to communications. No, but I said no, but I would like the ombudsman to know if, you know, the ombudsman would address this in a column was what I was interested in. You know, this should be out in the open. There was no media coverage, virtually no international media coverage of this, and hard questions weren't asked, to the best of my knowledge, which is not very good, as I was not able to get any interviews.
I'm sure that if they had let you in, there would have been a number of red faces.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure they're all very diplomatic, and they would have just sipped some tea and said, yes, next question.
Jocelyn Ford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies. Oh, no, you can't discuss.
Well, Keith, one of the news items that we led the program with was your fascination with Harold Camping and family radio, and also, I guess, the end of the world predictions, the doomsday predictions. What's that all about? Why are you so fascinated with that?
Well, I wouldn't say fascinated, but if you think about it, right, back in May, there was a prediction, May 21st, and then another one, October 21st. So you and I have effectively died twice. I'm wondering if there's going to be a third time, as they say, you know, three strikes and you're out. But the whole thing around family radio is quite unique. They get funds from many of their listeners to have programming on the air. And something that is quite odd, I think, is they actually have more hours on air than, let's say, Radio Canada International and Radio Netherlands combined. The budget is huge. So with these predictions that were going on, you know, you kind of wondered how is it going to impact family radio? Well, as we just heard recently, Harold Camping, who'd been at the helm for 53 years, has decided to retire. A joke that I heard 2 weeks ago from Sheldon Harvey, host of the International Radio Report. He says, well, the world ended May 21st, and I'm wondering if that's just for Harold Camping, you know?
Could be. So I understand then, I guess, why you would give them a second look and wonder a little bit about them. So you contacted them for an interview. And so how was that? How did that work out?
Well, that was very strange from the get-go. I called them up at their head office. First, they said, wait, we'll call you back. Nobody did. I called back the next day. Finally got through to somebody in the PR department. And I said, well, I want to do a short, brief interview about the end of the world, but these are the questions that I want to ask. And she said, okay, fine. Then I said, well, what's your name? She said, well, I can't give my name. And I went, oh, any particular reason? And she said, I can't really give it because we don't have an official position, which reminds me of what it's like calling a government agency in China. The representatives, of course, never give their names. So she said, okay, call at this time and we'll do an interview. So I called up on the date and the time that we had scheduled. We got into the interview, and probably maybe around 1 minute and 30 seconds later, I asked a question and she said, wait, I have to put you on hold. Then another person came on the line and I continued asking questions. And by the way, she also refused to give me her name. It was just a very odd thing. And the answers to me sounded sort of robotic. So I think, you know, we should relax a little bit. So I thought that right now would be the good time to listen to the full unedited interview for a little bit of comic relief. Well, Mr. Harold Camping was calling for the end of the world on October 21st.
I'm not in a position to answer anything like that, October 21st or May 21st. Only we have no further comment.
And any particular reason?
Do you have any more questions, so you can just write to Family Radio?
Well, I've written, and I haven't received a response yet.
Oh, you did write?
Yes.
To us already? Oh, okay. Did you address it to whom, sir?
I sent it to the following email. Actually, I sent it to the three ones, familyradio@familyradio.org, info@familyradio.org, and international@familyradio.org. Because I'm just curious about something, because the end of the world was predicted as being October 21st, but yet Family Radio last week put out their new B11 shortwave schedule a week before it. So if the end of the world is coming, why would Family Radio put out that schedule?
Oh, yeah, that question. Give me just a moment, please.
Hello, how may I help you?
I tune to Family Radio a number of times via shortwave from your relay exchange that you have with Radio Taiwan International.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious about something, because Mr. Harold Camping called for the end of the world October 21st, but yet a week before, or rather even 2 weeks before, Family Radio put out their new B11 schedule for the next 6 months. Why?
We're still here, as you can see.
Yeah, but if the end of the world was coming, why would you have put that schedule out?
Well, sir, we're still here, and life is going on until he actually comes, okay?
Uh-huh.
So, and I don't have any other statement.
But my question is still, why would the schedule be put out 6 months before, 2 weeks before, for the next 6 months?
I don't have answer to your question, sir.
You don't?
Right.
Well, one final question. Is a prediction like this going to be made again in the future?
I don't have a answer to your question, sir.
You don't have an answer. Is there somebody at Family Radio that does have an answer?
No, sir, we don't.
Really? And what about for all the people that donated money to Family Radio?
Well, we can deal with them directly, okay?
But will money be returned to them?
Sir, we will deal with them directly.
But will money be returned to them?
As they contact us, we will deal with them directly.
But that's not my question. My question is not will you deal with them, is will money that, let's say, was donated to Family Radio be returned to these people?
We will deal with them directly, sir.
But that's not the question that I was asking.
But that's my answer, sir.
Is that because you're not in a position to answer this?
I don't have any comments. I don't have any answer to you, okay?
Well, can you transfer me to somebody who does know?
We don't have anyone here.
Not even from the public relations department?
Oh, yes. We don't have public relations available for
them. Is there somebody in the program distribution department?
No, sir. We don't have anyone at all.
Nobody?
Yes.
So that means if I was to show up at your address in Oakland, California, at this very moment, there would be nobody there.
I'm saying we don't have anyone on the phone to talk to you regarding this subject.
Right, but I'm not asking about that now. I'm asking about the frequency department.
Sir, I think I answered your question. We don't have anyone at this moment to talk to you. We don't have any of those departments you were asking for to talk to you, okay? This is just material line, and that's the only line which is open at this time, okay?
Well, do you have the phone number to the main office?
This is main office.
Right, so you're saying that there's nobody there?
Sir, I'm saying nobody here to answer your question.
Okay, but let's say I had a different topic. Let's say I was interested.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing.
Always look on the bright side of life.
And by the way, you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. A while ago, we interviewed Greg Farley, an Englishman who's been working in the Middle East for many years in radio. He also spent 10 years in Lebanese radio. Fascinating, fascinating story. And I know that many of you thought that we should look at other foreigners that work in media in a different country. So today, my special guest now is going to be Rick O'Shea, who I worked with at China Radio International. For just over 10 years, Rick hosted the most popular English language radio show in China. It was called Joy FM. Now, in most countries, you do a radio show maybe 5 nights a week. This show was 7 nights a week. And this is going to be part one of an interview because Rick has just put out a book called Radio Chopsticks. But first, we're going to talk about how he ended up in China.
CRI English. It's them all.
你好 are you, my baby?
From Beijing, for China, this is Joy FM.
收音机前的朋友，你 How are you? 欢迎来到 CRI Music 晚间时段带给你的欢乐调频。
Yes, welcome to our program of Joy FM. 我是李克 I am Rick, R-I-C-K, Rick. With Jade, we say 你 How are you? Our bilingual greeting for our Joy FM family.
他所说的 Jade 就是我的另外一个名字王璐加李克再加上收音机前的每一个朋友今天晚上的聚会就到齐了让我们共同投身于 Coco 李文所为我们描述的一种疯狂状态 So crazy.
Ladies and funky gentlemen, this is the Coco Lee track. The Coco Lee track. Check it out.
You're what I would call a real radio guy. You've been in many different aspects of radio, not just working as an on-air presenter, but also as a programmer. When you were growing up in the U.S., and we'll get to the work that you've done here in Asia, but the work that you started off doing, was this something that you always dreamed of doing? I mean, were you one of those kids growing up in the bedroom would talk into a toy tape recorder at the age of 10 thinking, this is what I want to do?
Good question. No. It was never anything that I thought I would ever do. I was not one of those guys who wanted to be in radio.I didn't want to be, I used to listen to a lot of radio. Growing up in Detroit, great musical place to grow up with rock and Motown, soul, we had everything. And no, I did not want to be in radio. I had no idea about it.
So what happened then? What was it, that sparked your interest to going into this very, the only word I can think of is crazy career?
I'm glad you asked because I've got a book coming out later this year that explains all of that. It's a book about my life and it's a real story about how I got into radio, how I listened to radio, how I got into it, how I stayed in radio, and how I ended up going from Detroit to Beijing with stops along the way for a few years in Shanghai and also in Hong Kong and Taipei and Hawaii and Florida. So it's actually all in my book.It's all a matter of fate. The real story is I got into radio I was listening to a radio station in Florida, and they sucked. They were terrible. So they said, we need people to come here and sell radio advertising. And I went to the station because now I knew where they were. And now I knew the location. I walked in there. I said, I don't really want to work here. I don't want a job as a salesperson. I just want to tell you, you guys suck.There's only two stations in this area, and you both are terrible. So I just came in here to file my verbal complaint, and that's how I got into radio. They hired me on the spot.
So you ended up in Taiwan, and when you came here, because Taiwan is a very different radio market, it probably was then as well, was it shocking for you, or was it for you the same?
It wasn't as shocking as it might be if I had flown from Florida to Taiwan.But I had that in-between stop of 3 years in Hawaii, and Hawaii is such a racial mix with many Chinese and Japanese and Philippine, that the Asian aspect to a living place, I'd already experienced it, and I actually liked it. So it wasn't as drastic of a change as one might think, although it was quite a difference, that's for sure. My idea was to stay for 1 year.
For 1 year?
Yeah, I had a one-year contract, and I thought maybe I'll go for 2 years. But in fact, I had a job offer in Hong Kong.
And how long have you been in Asia now?
more than 30 years. Actually, more than half my life so far.
So you went then from Taiwan to Hong Kong, which then was still a British colony. Mm-hmm. What was it like working in radio then? Because Hong Kong has an amazing radio history.
It was very cool because I worked on an AM station on commercial radio. I worked there for about 11 years. And then after that, I went to the new FM bilingual station, which was much better because it wasn't all English. It was half and half English and Chinese. So we were entering the main market, and it's kind of fun to be in the main market rather than the fringe market, which only English radio is and was in Hong Kong.
You spent 15 years in Hong Kong, and then you ended up in China. Was your plan just to visit all the major centers in Asia? What was going on here?
I never had a plan to move to the mainland at all. It was never anything that I considered, but one day a guy said, you know, we have a program on the mainland, and it's made in Hong Kong, but we're now going to make it in Shanghai. So do you want to move to Shanghai and move away from Hong Kong? And that program was Joy FM, a bilingual program that was on every night. And I accepted the offer because the station I had worked at in Hong Kong was turning into a financial station. So they were taking away the music and the bilingual approach. So it was the perfect time to leave Hong Kong. But it was, again, it was an offer that was made to me over dinner one night.
Now, you did Joy FM for a very long time. And, you know, I was talking recently with a radio programmer in Kitchener, Ontario. And I said, you know, you could be doing a radio show in China and have maybe 5 million listeners, which in China is considered a small audience.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Which is considered a small audience. I mean, Joy FM. It's amazing when we worked together at China Radio International, and I spent 8 years in Beijing. I was impressed at how many people knew Joy FM.
Well, you know, when you're here and when you do a program that really fits the market and leads the market, then you've got something special. And we tried for that. Well, there was a purpose. We actually wanted to do that. We weren't just filling space in between songs. We wanted people to have something fresh, new, creative, and innovative. And I think that's where we brought it during the 11 years that I was on Joy FM. And amazingly, it was on every single night. How many radio programs are on every night?
And that's seven days a week.
Yeah, you know, I think give the audience a break, man. It's nice to come back on Monday and say, well, I had a great weekend. Let me tell you about it. But it was on continuously for 11 years, every single night. So, you know, new things in radio, and they don't do things the same here as they might somewhere else.
Clark, good to hear from you. Thanks for the email. 7 days, here's the latest from Craig David on Joy FM.
And that was my conversation with my good friend Rick O'Shea. And we're going to be bringing you part two of the interview to talk about his book, Radio Chopsticks, on an upcoming edition of the program. Now, just over a year ago, PCJ started the Happy Station Show Friendship Sponsorship Program. What is it? Well, for $10, $5, or $1, you can buy PCJ items at a discount, things like coffee mugs and t-shirts. It is also a way that listeners can let us know what they think and that they support the programs, a little bit like what NPR Public Television does in the United States. Now, what was not announced, because I kept it under my hat, was that we had some shortwave radios for a draw. Yes, the Texan PL600.
And the three winners are Mark Cody in Ontario, Canada, Carlos da Silva in Lisbon, Portugal, and Marie Cortez in Sacramento, California. So congratulations to the three of you. The radios will be sent out this week, and we'll contact you with the tracking number.
Now, if you think that, oh, you just did the draw. No, don't worry, because we're going to be doing it again next spring. So all you need to do is just buy a Happy Station Show Friendship Sponsorship membership for $10, $5, or $1. If you go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, you will find all the details on the right page. You can pay by MasterCard, Visa, American Express, or the easiest way, by PayPal. Well, you know, Paulette, from time to time, we get some unusual emails from listeners. Either they don't put their name attached to it, or they say, can you send me a QSL card, but they don't put any address. But we actually got one that I think was a great idea. A listener by the name of Ted Morrison in Manchester in the United Kingdom said that we should, on each show, play a song about radio. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think that's a great idea.
Now, his first suggestion. Now, I want to see first if you remember this. If I mention the call letters WKRP. Does that how I should say, stir up any memories?
Oh boy, does it ever.
Now, WKRP was a very popular American sitcom a long, long time ago. It had a great cast of characters about this radio station in Cincinnati. Paulette, which character sticks out in your mind?
Well, for me, I think probably the most flamboyant, most memorable character would have been the Lonnie Anderson character with all that hair from the 1980s.
Definitely. My favorite characters have to be Les Nessman, who was the newsreader, who always did Hog Report, and Johnny Fever, who was the morning guy, who was mostly stoned most of the time.
Who can forget him?
Right? Yeah, exactly. And you know, the funny thing is, when I watch the show now, after having been now in radio for over 20 years, I can honestly say there are people in that show that I can identify with as real people that I have met somewhere along the way. It's quite scary.
Well, I think, Keith, I'm going to have to run out and get the DVDs and watch it again myself.
Anyway, without further ado, here's the theme song to WKRP, sung by Steve Carlisle.
Baby, if you've ever wondered whatever became of me, I'm living on the air in Cincinnati, Cincinnati WKRP. Got kind of tired of packing and unpacking, town to town, up and down the dial. Maybe you and me were never meant to be, just maybe think of me once in a while. Heading up that highway, leaving you behind, hardest thing I ever had to do. Broke my heart in two, but baby, pay no mind. The price for finding me was losing you. Memories help me hide my lonesome feeling, far away from you and feeling low. It's getting late, my friend, my love, I miss you so. Take good care of you, I've gotta go.
WKRP in Cincinnati, the theme song to the TV show of the same name, sung by Steve Carlisle. And that was a request that was sent to us by Ted Morrison in Manchester in the United Kingdom. And if there's a song about radio that you would like us to play on the monthly edition of the show, just stay tuned. We'll give out all the contact information later on. Now, this past week, shortwave reception has been excellent. What is the propagation going to be like over the next 7 days? Here's Dan Hensley.
On October 29th, 10.7 centimeter flux predicted of 135, A index of 7, KP index of 3. On October 30th, 10.7 centimeter flux of 130, A index of 5, KP index of 2. On October 31st, happy Halloween, 10.7 centimeter flux of 130, A index of 5, KP index of 2. On November 1st, a 10.7 centimeter prediction of 125, A index of 5, KP index of 2. On November 2nd, 10.7 centimeter flux of 125, A index of 5, KP index of 2. November 3rd, 10.7 centimeter flux of 125, A index of 8, KP index of 3. On November 4th, 10.7 centimeter flux of 120, A index of 8, KP index of 3. Seven sunspot groups are currently in view. Numbers 1324, 1325, 1327, 1330, 1332, and 1333. This past weekend saw huge band openings from 20 meters upper sideband through the high end of 10 meters around 28.995 kilohertz upper sideband. The KP index for 27 October was 0, which is absolutely perfect. The A indexes for this week will be high enough to disrupt butter propagation, while the KP index and the 10.7 centimeter flux will be our best hope for good propagation this week. Back to you, Keith.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan Hensley. Anyway, we're nearly at the conclusion of today's program. If you wish to contact us, Paulette, what's our email address?
It is MNP, and that stands, of course, for Media Network Plus. MNP at pcjmedia.com.
And of course, you can download this edition and all past editions of the program by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com.
So for me, Paulette Macquarie in Vancouver, Canada.
And for me, Keith Palo in Taipei, Taiwan.
So long and see you again soon.
Best 73s and 88s to the ladies.